Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum, the companion podcast to the new Undisclosed series, The State versus Greg Lantz. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. I'll be hosting this series. I'm the host of a podcast called Crime Writers On, and you also may know me as the audio producer of the main episodes of Undisclosed. And we have our guests this week, some that you know and some we haven't heard from in a little while. We've got Rabia Chaudhry, an attorney, author of the New York Times bestseller Adnan Story, and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast and the lead reporter on this series. Hi, Rabia.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm great. And it's really fun to hear this series to come to fruition, considering that I actually saw you in person in Tennessee when you were researching it, right?
Some of it. Yeah, that's right.
Also with us is Colin Miller, a.k.a. Legal Siri. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and one of the hosts of Undisclosed. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm great. And also with us, and I'm thrilled to have him because I think his experience is particularly relevant for this episode, is Bob Ruff, the creator and host of the Truth and Justice podcast. Of course, prior to shifting his work towards investigating wrongful convictions, Bob was a firefighter. He spent 15 years in the fire service. And when he took an early retirement in 2016, he held the rank of fire chief. He has a degree in fire science and served as the director of the fire science program at Southwestern Michigan College. In that role, Bob taught classes ranging from firefighting strategies and tactics to arson investigation. Hello, Bob. It's awesome talking to you.
Hey, Rebecca. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, just to give a quick overview of the first episode in this series, it's called Fully Involved. And if you haven't listened to it, before you listen to this addendum, you should go back. It's about a couple, Victor and Alla Kolesnikow, who were shot and murdered on August 5th, 1998 at around 3 a.m. in Cooksville, Tennessee. Their house was set on fire with their bodies in it. Neighbors across the street heard an explosion and a car speeding away and then saw the fire and called 911. When the fire captain arrived 3 minutes after the 911 call at 3:30 a.m., the house was, quote, fully involved. After fighting the fire for hours, the victims' bodies were found in the front bedroom. Alla in bed, shot three times in the head. Victor on the floor near the bed, shot three times. The gasoline pattern found around the bodies, bedroom, and in the trail throughout the house and out the opposite end pointed to arson. The damage was so severe that investigators could not determine the status of the alarm system. Wire cutters were found in the yard undamaged, and investigators searched for vehicles to match the description given by witnesses. Now, Rabia, this sounds pretty much as you describe in the podcast. Victor Kolesnikow was a nuclear scientist, and I felt a little bit like I was listening to the plot of an Americans episode, listening to this episode of Undisclosed.
Right. Well, I haven't seen the Americans, but yeah, it was. But I'll take your word for it. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, because, you know, when I first heard about this case, I was like, what is this couple, this Ukrainian couple doing in the middle of Cookville? And Cookville has built up a bit now, but, you know, 1998, it was, you know, much more rural than it is now. And we dug a little further and we figured out what he was doing in Tennessee, period, which is working at Oak Ridge. And I guess maybe he just liked Tennessee after he stopped working for the government, put down roots there, and just began buying properties and buying and selling and renting properties. And that became his thing.
All right. So, Colin, the details of this case and of the victim in particular, they're interesting, right? I mean, they don't necessarily point to a conventional murder story when you hear about what Kolesnikow did for a living.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't the type of person you would expect to be killed in this type of elaborate murder arson where the arson seems to be covering up that murder. As you said, it's kind of like Shades of the Americans, where is there something else going on that we don't know about? But certainly he's not the type of person you would expect would be the victim in this case.
All right. Now, Bob, when you heard the details of what the investigators found, the alarm system, a gasoline pattern in the house, bodies of people that were murdered and the house was set on fire, what were your initial thoughts? Have you ever investigated a scene like this?
Not anything quite that elaborate, but I've investigated a lot of fires and fires that were arsons used to cover up another crime. And I don't think that there's any question at all that this was an arson. I mean, the fact that the bodies had, you know, bullet wounds, and it sounds like there was a pretty clear pour pattern throughout the house. and the speed at which the House became fully involved, which is something, you know, we'll talk about, I'm sure, as we move a little forward, because, you know, the arson investigators report said that the fire had been burning for 20 minutes before discovery, but there's actually no way that anyone can know that. But I think that there's no question this was an arson.
Now, I'm just curious about that. What do you mean when you say there's no way nobody could know that? Because the fire captain did believe the house had been on fire for 20 minutes, as you said, given the condition of the property. You've seen the pictures, right? And read the descriptions?
I have. And I've read the reports. And so there's too many unknown factors. And the fact that there was gasoline poured in the house changes everything. So when it appears to me that the pour pattern went throughout the house and all the way out the door, called a trailer, so that's a way that someone then can, from the outside of the building, throw a match into the gasoline and it'll go in. You know, the house is filled with fumes, which is what I'm guessing that when people said they heard an explosion, my presumption is that's what they were hearing. So when you know, as most people know, when gasoline burns, it's not the liquid, the gasoline on the floor that's burning, it's the vapors that come off of it. And that would very quickly fill up the volume of the house. So when you light that fire, even if you do it outside, so if anybody's ever been around, you know, out here in rural Michigan, bonfires are a thing, and a lot of people like to pour. It's very dangerous. Don't do it. But pour gasoline all over the fire and then make a little trailer and light it. And even that will make an explosion sound when it ignites. But what's happening when you do it inside of a box, we all remember back from like high school science class, the picture of the molecules looks like a little infinity sign. They show how the molecules are moving through the air. And when they heat up, they move faster and they take up more space. Well, so essentially this, and you can, to understand this better, the way I would teach my students would be, if you take a bottle, an empty bottle of water and seal it up tight so that, you know, there's a little bit of moisture still in there. But if you set that bottle out in a hot parking lot on a summer day, the bottle will expand to the point of almost exploding. And if you take that same bottle and you put it inside your freezer, it'll shrink up and actually crinkle up the bottle. And so what's happening is it's the same number of air molecules inside of the container, but when they get hot, they take up more space. And when they get colder, they take up less space. So in this instance, the house is the container, right? And so there's air in the house. When that gasoline ignites, all of the air molecules in the entire house get real hot real fast, and they take up way more space than will fit inside that container. So it's explosive, you know, because that's how bombs work. It's not so much the fire coming out of it. It's the pressure that is forcing the container that can't hold it to blow into pieces. And that's what happens. So I think that's the explosion that people were hearing. And in that case, it would ignite. There would be an explosive force. It would ignite everything in the house at once. But then the fire would die right back down, you know, because there wouldn't be sustained burning. But now you have multiple items throughout the entire house that are all ignited and are starting to release heat. And that heat builds up exponentially within the house. The pressure builds up again. And then you reach what would be almost another explosive event, which would be a flashover when everything in the house reaches its ignition temperature at the same time. And that same thing occurs. Everything bursts into flames again. It creates more pressure. The container, the house can't hold all that pressure. And that's when the house really gets to rocking and become fully involved. But it sounded to me like the witness statements, they heard the explosion, as they called it, and then looked out and saw the house was on fire. That could have happened seconds. The house could have been ignited seconds before the fire was discovered.
Right. And the, you know, doors and windows could have just been closed, right? And then that could have been the sound of just like the air blowing out the doors and the windows, right?
Right.
Bob, let me ask you, do you think the witnesses, the explosion they heard was like the first explosion or the second one you're talking about?
The second one wouldn't have made the sound, the explosive. So I said it was explosive. That's not entirely accurate. It wouldn't have made the sound that the first one did for a number of reasons. The first one very likely would have blown out windows and doors, and it would have, you know, that pressure has to get out somewhere. So it would find places to get out, which means the second time when the house then auto ignites in the flashover, at that point, the house is better ventilated. So there's no container to hold in to cause that big boom sound. It would just be, if for me as a firefighter being in fires when this is happening inside, it's very loud, but it's not like an explosion that you would hear across the street, like when the gasoline was ignited.
I remember when I first read about it and I looked at the pictures, and the closest experience I have to this, and I'm sure a lot of people have this experience because we've all done this and it's totally stupid to do it, is to put all that lighter fluid on top of like, you know, charcoal briquettes and then throw a match in and it's like this instant like boom and then it kind of dies back down. Yeah, it's terrifying. Right. You know, it's not smart to do. Don't do it. But this is like on just such a big scale.
Right. So the science is the same. It's just on a greater scale. And then the other difference is, imagine if in your grill, right, you have all your charcoal, you pour the lighter fluid on it, and you light it, and it woo, and then it starts to die down again. Imagine if you had, say, a bunch of pieces of paper in the grill along with that charcoal, and because of that big woo, now all that paper's burning, and it's filling up the grill with more heat, and it's going to cause that secondary flashover.
Now, Colin, you know, in cases that, you know, you may have looked at or may not have looked at, I'm just curious at your thoughts, because I feel like anecdotally even, and even like in pop culture cases involving fires, there is kind of a civilian witness perception of events, like what we think we know about fires and how they work and explosions and how they sound versus the science and the reality on the ground, both what's, you know, provable and not provable. Is this the first case you've looked at where there's been evidence like this and, you know, conflicting reports that could have skewed the timeline?
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever really seen a case. I sort of, I guess, worked partially on maybe, you know, a half dozen of these cases involving an arson. I can't remember a single case where there were questions about the timeline. The timeline always seemed relatively fixed. There are, and Bob can probably speak more to this, there are a lot of myths about fire science, things like crazing of the glass and making determinations about whether it's an arson or an accidental fire. And that's sort of what I've focused on, is a lot of junk science in arson that's been corrected now. But yeah, this is the very first case I've seen where really we have conflicting accounts that go to when this fire was actually started.
Well, Robbie, there were some witnesses here, some neighbors who lived kind of on this compound-like property, including the Redmonds. They're brothers, right?
Right.
Now, they said that there was an alarm, a light system, a handwritten note in the file says the Redmonds told police on the night of the fire that Victor had a motion-sensored light and alarm system in his home. This system may have been disabled right beforehand or earlier. Can these systems be disabled from outside the house? Because there were wire cutters found outside the house, right?
Yeah, the wire cutters appear over and over because the police thought they might be an important piece of evidence. I don't think it was never really tied to anything later down the road, but that's a question that I had. I don't know. I'm guessing if these systems are wired externally, then maybe. But the reports are so conflicting about it. It seems like people who are familiar with the property and the Klesnick house were like, they definitely had some motion, like light motion sensor thingy that the lights went on if something like random even moved outside. But apparently nobody has reported that happened. There was apparently an alarm system, which was, I think, separate from that motion system. And either it was disabled. I mean, like there was the one report saying that they were having trouble with it, so they disarmed it themselves. They're trying to figure it out. Another one said that it was just they couldn't determine like what happened, whether or not it was disabled or even existed. And it was, but you know, it seemed like, you know, Victor, I think, as a nuclear scientist, as somebody who was, he was a pretty sharp man. He was pretty savvy. And I think he was, you know, knew how to protect his property. But clearly that night, something happened that somebody was able to either disable it or they knew it wasn't working. And I thought that was, yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear here that this fire was intended to cover up this other crime. The fire was not the crime. The fire was an evidence-destroying exercise, right?
Oh, certainly, yeah. It was just to, I think, destroy any kind of evidence. I mean, fingerprints. I think, you know, Bob, right, you can't lift fingerprints from, like, burned items, right?
No, not that I'm aware of. And, you know, and there's so many, and this, you know, Colin mentioned some junk science with fire science, and that's absolutely right. There's a lot, and I've said for years, junk science when it comes to fire science has mostly to do with overzealous investigators trying to say that they can prove something happened that they can't. And that alarm system is one of those things. There's a lot of chicken and egg scenarios that comes into finding point and origin of a fire. For example, electrical shorts. You know, sometimes an electrical short can cause a fire, but fires also cause electrical shorts. So, you know, you'll find wires that are beaded up that you can tell that they shorted out, but you don't know if they came before the fire and caused the fire or the fire came before and caused the short. So with the alarm system, I'm not surprised that there's no way that they can. And in this case, it sounds like, it, you know, everything was just completely burned up. So there's just no way that they can know definitively whether it was even active or working at the time.
Now, I have some questions about sort of this deliberate arson of the house and the scene. They found gasoline under Victor's body and a pattern of gas throughout the house. I know this might be a tough question to answer, but are we talking about a lot of gas here? Are we talking about like two big gas containers, one small one? Are we talking about like a lot of gas that may have been outside in a car that someone would have had to go get and then carry in after the shootings? Like how messy and difficult is a scene like this to set? Is it typical for there to be gas sort of in one room and then for it to be like in a trail? Is that just like them running away? Is that intentional? I guess I just kind of, Bob, would love your thoughts, you know, from your experience of what you imagine, without getting into too much speculation, it would have taken to burn down this house in this way with this kind of fuel.
It wouldn't have taken much. As you all know, gas is very, very explosive. And so it doesn't take a whole lot. And the best way, when I'm looking at a scene like this, to try to determine maybe the amount of gasoline necessary to cause it, is not so much in volume, because it's hard for our brains to think about. Even you know, if you put a pint of blood on the ground, and you'd be shocked how wide of a pool that can make, just one pint. But with gasoline, what I always think about with something that we can all relate to is time. So imagine if you have if most of us have probably done this, say a 5 gallon or a 2 gallon gas can, and we're filling our lawnmower with gas. How long do you have to stand there for all that gas to come out of the can to fill the tank? And then think about the amount of distance that was traveled from the bed, which was the point where they were really trying to burn, and then to make the trailer. I mean, you can walk through the house in, you know, just a number of seconds. I would say that with this fire, they could have made that poor pattern with a gallon of gasoline. And that just depends on how over, you know, how much they know about what they're doing, right? So are they putting 5 gallons of gasoline on top of the victims, making sure there's enough, not realizing it's only going to take a little bit? It's because they're not going to run away. They're already deceased at that time. But as far as I think it wouldn't have taken much. A gallon gas can, a 2.5 gallon gas can, which is a pretty common size, would have been plenty to make this pour pattern. And regarding the pattern of the trail, that is very common when you see an arson fire. Most people are smart enough to know not to light a room on fire full of gas when they're in it. So typically that's what they'll do. They'll light up an area, or they'll spread it throughout a house, and then they'll make that little trail all the way out so they can, from the outside, light the edge of the gas trail, and it'll run into the house and then explode like that. And when they don't do that, typically you find the arsonist's body inside the fire along with the residents.
That's what I was wondering too. Is there sort of a difference between somebody who's good at this, let's say, I mean, there's no other way to put it, and somebody who has never done it before, in terms of like the burns they might sustain, in terms of the way they might spill the gas around, in terms of the amount of time they'd give themselves? Like, can you tell a difference when you're investigating a scene, whether it's a pro or somebody that just had this idea and decided to give it a try?
I think there's too many unknowns, because obviously this scene to me looks like someone who is criminally sophisticated enough with arson to know how to very efficiently and effectively and quickly light the house on fire without injuring or hurting themselves and getting out of there. But at the same time, 90% of the people I went to high school with would know how to do the same thing, because we've used the same methodology to light bonfires, you know. So and we're talking about, sounds like, pretty rural Tennessee. I mean, I think most people, you don't have to be advanced criminals or really highly educated. It's a practical experience thing. Know that, you know, you need to make that trailer and you need to get away from it when you light it on fire.
Now, I live in New Hampshire, so I'm comfortable saying this. What you're saying is that a redneck could also be an expert in setting fires. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly right. And as a redneck myself, that's exactly what I was trying to avoid saying.
Yeah. Can I ask a question to Bob?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, Bob, let me ask you. So one of the things that I, you know, that's really important for me to try to figure out, or, you know, as we're looking at this case, is, you know, you explain how, and in this case, Captain Lane, who was the fire captain at the time, said, you know, his theory is that the person poured the gasoline throughout the house, then got outside, I think the kitchen door, and then threw a match in. And when he threw that match in, it exploded. Now, if windows and doors are getting blown out, wouldn't that person also have, like, maybe gotten injured pretty badly, gotten burned, singed? I mean, how quickly do you have to get out of there to save yourself?
I don't think – I wouldn't expect any injuries from this person if they – so – when I haven't seen from the photos I've seen, I can tell that part of the house still remains standing and a good portion of it burned to the ground, which would indicate to me that they didn't pour the gasoline through the entire house. So part of that heat expanding when those gasoline vapors ignite, it's looking for a place to go, and you have half the house that's not ignited. So it's going to spread. It wouldn't necessarily, I can't say that it blew windows and doors out. It may have. It's going to find the weakest point. So some of the fire probably would have came right back out that door, but it wouldn't have been, and it wouldn't have been a sustained burn.
Okay. The part of the house that was still kind of standing was actually the bedroom. The part of the house that was completely, like, you know, pretty much burned to cinders was actually pretty much the rest of it, including all the way up through where they would have lit the match from.
Right. So the actual bedroom where the bodies were found was the part that was still standing?
Yeah, the brick structure that you see, that was where the bodies are found, yeah.
Well, because it was brick, right? And probably because, you know, that may have been the rest of the house. They're probably careful to kind of like seal off that room in some ways as they were leaving, thinking it might. I mean, it's easy for me to see how that would happen. It's almost like the unintended consequence of being maybe too careful.
Well, when the house burns to the ground, what you got to realize is what causes that to happen is a sustained burn. You know, the firefighter described it as fully engulfed or fully involved. That means the structure itself is burning, and that doesn't necessarily indicate where the fire originated. It has a lot more to do with the venting. So like I said, when they lit it, there would have been this kind of explosive thing that's going to light a lot of stuff in the house on fire. The couches, the rugs, the curtains, the blankets, anything that's around is all catching fire now, right, and building heat. And so from that point, you're going to see the most damage and the most deep charred burning and destructive burning happening based on the vent pattern. So you know that door is left open, so you've got a place for air to come in. If through that explosion, like I said, it's going to find the weakest point. So say there was a window in another part of the house away from the bedroom that blew out during that explosion. Now you have that direct path of ventilation to get through there, and you will expect to see much more damage from the fire in that path than back at the bedroom where... I don't know if there was windows left standing in that room, but if those windows stayed closed, there's no air path travel for the fire to really get back in there. I mean, it will eventually burn, and it did, but you would expect more burning to happen in the path of travel where there's the most ventilation and the air can get to the fire.
I was curious, Robbie, there were animals in the house, right? Or one or more pets in the house?
Well, I mean, we know they own some chickens. There are pictures of like a coop in the backyard. And it could be that because the coop was at a distance, maybe, you know, they were fine. It's just weird that there's no mention of any of them in the report. But they did have a dog. And that dog, apparently they kept chained either by the front door or it was like on the property in the house. It was a dog that kept her. And there's just nobody has any idea. I have asked every single person I could. I mean, have you heard anything about the dog? Do you have any idea? Nobody knows. So I don't know what happened to it, but I'm guessing, I mean, I'd ask Bob this, that if, you know, the dog had been killed in the fire as well, like that would have been noted in the reports, right?
It should have been. Unless there's more arson investigative reports than what you sent me, I was actually really disappointed that the report was so short. I mean, when I would do an investigative report for a fire, we had different form. We called them when I was a fire. We had a 4-page form and a 10-page form. The 10-page form was for any fire that required a full investigation that we suspected to be arson, and that wasn't including the narrative. And my narrative would be pages long of every little detail about what we found, where, and so that you just had this little blurb of a narrative there in those reports that you sent me. And
Did you read, I don't know if you read the Philip Gentry report is like 4 or 5 pages long. So maybe, I don't know if you got a chance to look at that. So there is more, but
yeah, it should have been noted. I mean, I personally would note every little detail within my report. And if there was, especially with, It's a whole different ballgame when it becomes a criminal investigation. And this very clearly was a criminal investigation right from the very beginning. So I would expect questions like that because, you know, from an investigative standpoint, not a fire investigative, but from a law enforcement investigative standpoint, that's very relevant. If there's a dog, where's the dog? Is the dog in the house? Did the dog die in the fire? Did the dog get shot? If the dog didn't get shot and it was in the house and apparently the victims didn't wake up, then that would indicate that this likely is someone that the victims knew, that the dog knew. You know, there's a lot of questions that would be answered if you knew what happened with the dog, and the fact that it's not mentioned is frustrating.
Well, speaking of which, you said that you would make detailed notes. One of the things that was weird to me, and I noted this in the episode, was that not a single one of the many, like a dozen or so reports, and even the ones that came out later, ever mentioned a gas can on the property. And then when the sheriff and I think one of the firefighters was specifically asked by journalists the next day or so, they specifically said no gas can was found on the property. But then it kind of pops up in an evidence log as a red plastic container found on front yard. I've looked at every picture over and over again. I see nothing that matches that description. Would that be a crazy oversight if there's a gas can in the front yard?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like this was a pretty... I mean, I'm guessing this municipality maybe has never dealt with anything like this or doesn't deal with it often. But yeah, I mean, that's huge. You should be trying to figure out, especially when you know it's an arson and you know it's very, just from the photos, you can tell immediately that very likely that this was the pour pattern on the ground, that it was or on the floor, that this was an intentionally set fire, likely with gas. That's the first thing you want to do is try to find a gas can, because that's something you might be able to pull fingerprints off of. And again, when you move out of the fire side and in the investigative side, that gas can, it tells you a lot. If there's not a single gas can found anywhere on the property, presumably they have a lawnmower or something that takes gas. That would be an indication that whoever killed them came without a gas can and took their gas can. And then you have to ask yourself, why? Why would they go there without it? Were they not planning to do it? There's a lot of questions that could be answered. And the dog and the gas can are two, it seems like, big question marks that shouldn't be there.
No, I agree with you. And these were big missing pieces that stuck out to me in listening to the episode. Another big thing that stuck out to me is, you know, the way the bodies were found. It's clear that Alla was killed while in bed, likely as she slept. Three bullets in the head. Robbie, you described it in your script as execution style. Victor got up and was killed apparently right next to the bed, standing next to Alla's side of the bed with his hand still clutching the bed rail.
Actually, Colin, he was on the opposite side of the bed.
He was on the opposite side. Okay. So, yeah. But he was up. Something had gotten him up. Either he was, awakened by...
Then he had collapsed next to the bed, yeah.
Okay. Colin, did you find yourself like kind of trying to picture how this could possibly have happened when you heard that this was the setup of the crime scene?
Yeah, definitely. You hear it and you're trying to, in your head, reimagine it. And this is why, at trial so many times the prosecution will have an animation to see it, because it is kind of tough to picture in your head and keep straight exactly what they're saying this crime scene looked like.
Now, Robbie, a note that you made, and this is where I was mistaken just now, was that the killer was likely standing next to Alla's side of the bed while shooting Victor. Do you think that that's what happened?
I mean, I've tried to imagine the scene many times and also imagine... So Alla gets shot. When Victor gets out of bed, he's literally shot like almost as soon as he stands up, because he collapses right next to, like where somebody would get up. You get up from bed and you're shot immediately and you collapse. He's also shot on the left side. All of the shots, bullets are on his left side. One is in abdomen, chest, and head. And to me, I don't think there would have been enough time for the killer to shoot Alla three times in the head while in the dark while she's sleeping, then go around the bed and then shoot Victor. I mean, in the dark, I think Victor would have gotten further than just like having stepped out of bed. And I think what happened was I think that the killer shot Alla in the head. Victor's sleeping on her right side, and then just picked up the, just raised the gun. And as soon as Victor got up, shot three times again. And that's why all the bullets hit Victor also from the left side, because that's the side the killer was standing on. That's what makes sense to me. I just don't think there would have been time for the killer to go around the other side and then try to hunt Victor down. I think Victor would have gotten further than where he did. But the one of the odd things to me was that Victor's hand was still clutching the rail of the bed, even you know, when they found his body, like, completely burned, I just didn't know that was even possible.
Hmm.
Did the autopsy show that when you're saying that he was still clutching the bed, that doesn't, once you get shot, you know, you lose, you know, when you're burned, your tendons and muscle, your tendons will tighten up and the body will kind of clutch into a grip. But if he was already killed before that, he should have been limp on the ground. That does the autopsy show there's like no sign of charring in his lungs, that he was for sure completely dead before the fire started?
Yeah, I don't. The autopsy doesn't show any sign of smoke inhalation or that he, all of the fire injuries were apparently post-mortem to both the bodies.
Wow, that's really interesting. The whole scene's really interesting because even the three shots, if you walk into a room with two people, like, I just can't, why would someone take the time to shoot somebody in the head three times before they turn to the next person when that's just giving that person time to move? And I guess the other thing we got to consider when we're talking about where they were positioned, that, you know, where they were standing and they didn't have time to get away. We also have to remember to consider when someone's pointing a gun at you and telling you to do something, you usually do it, you know, so it could have been more time. It could have been, stay right there. If you move, I'm going to kill you. You know, I mean, there could be another reason why they were still there, but the whole thing is very, very strange to me, especially a shot to the head. And when you shoot somebody in the head, most people are pretty convinced that that person is deceased or going to die.
Yeah.
And one of the shots was right between the eyes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Which is, you know.
Right.
That's why I keep saying the whole thing has a very Americans kind of vibe to it. Now, I know, Rob, you said you haven't seen the show, and Colin, you have. Like, there's like a lot of overkill that those spies tend to do. And then, and I'm obviously not, I don't want to speculate that that's what's going on here. But, you know, when Robbie kind of laid out, you know, the backstory here, and then it's talking about the circumstances of the crime, it did have a very kind of overkill feel to it, and felt, for lack of a better word, and I hate using this word when describing real people, but like a cinematic kind of scene in terms of like the wounds, the way it happened, him still clutching the bed. Colin, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, and Bob was just pointing it out too. When you have, you know, three bullets in the head, that is overkill. I mean, that's not what you would expect, especially when there's multiple victims. It's not a case of you're just killing one person. And it does seem strange, given the circumstances of what we think happened here, to have those three separate bullets. And so, yeah, I mean, Rebecca, you don't want to speculate too much, but this does seem almost, as you say, more cinematic than something you would expect to see in real life.
That's right.
It's interesting to me, given his background, and I don't know if it's the investigators didn't know his background at the time, that they didn't consider that, was this like some kind of a hit? It was never investigated that way at all. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this was in 1998, we sort of aren't in the age of, you know, putting Russian spies at the same front of mind place as they have today and as they had like in the 80s. But certainly that's where I would have thought about investigators looking right away.
One thing I wanted to actually point out, and you mentioned it earlier, Rebecca, we didn't get a chance to talk about it a lot, but I do want to point this out so our listeners also remember this kind of going forward, is that, you know, the story is that the Redmond brothers, you know, heard this explosion, and then one of the Redmond brothers told his wife to call 911, which happened pretty immediately within that minute or so. They call 911, the call comes in at 3:30. So let's say they hear the explosion like at 3:28. Well, Sally Pellicciotti, who lived next to the victims, actually said in her statement that around 3 a.m. is when she started seeing a glow in the woods, and she didn't know what was going on, but she kind of stayed in her room because around 3 o'clock in the morning, her dog started barking. And so she stayed in her room until 3:30, which is around 3:30 is when she heard sirens and stuff, and she felt safe enough to come out and see what was going on. But her recollection, it was about 30 minutes later. And so I guess for me, like, the timing of when the fire actually started and when this call was made, it's all, you know, a little bit off to me. But one thing I always wondered was, and you did say this at the top of the episode, Bob, but when Captain Lane got there and he saw this house fully involved, about how long do you think it would have been burning before it was to that point where you've got flames going 20, 30 feet off the roof?
That's going to happen as soon as the fire finds a vent point to get outside and really free burn. It doesn't take a real long time. But there's just too many unknowns. You know, if this was, you know, in 1950, it would be a different scenario. When everything was natural building material, things were made out of cottons and linens. By 1998, your whole house is full of plastic. They're all petroleum-based products. It's basically, you're right now, wherever you're sitting, all three of you, you're covered in you're surrounded by gasoline. Your carpet's made from plastic. Your chairs are made from plastic. The table you might be sitting at is a petroleum-based glue holding it together. And so the heat release rate of all of those items just adds heat into the house really, really, really quickly compared to the way it used to. So it just depends on the venting and, you know, how much air can get to it, how many things ignited to begin with. I mean, I've seen videos, and you can find videos online if you Google flash overtimes. You'll see some YouTube videos of firefighter trainings where they show how quickly, say, a Christmas tree in a house can erupt into the whole house on fire, and it's seconds. So, and that's what I said. You know, I'm not saying it didn't take 20 minutes to get to that point. I'm saying you can't determine that it did. There's too many unknown variables.
You know, one of the big questions that I had also near the end of the episode, we heard a portion of the warrant that was read about the car that agent, is it Krofsik, was trying to get a warrant to search, matching a description given by witnesses. But Rabia, can you just clarify for me, there was never any description of a car given by any witnesses, right?
No, there was not a single witness who actually saw a car that night. Just the two Redmond brothers saying that they heard a car speed away. But, you know, it's interesting to me that Agent Krofsik, to get the warrant, you know, specifically said that this car he wanted to search matched the description, which is a lie. I mean, there was no such description. But, you know, it's just like indicative of how we want to rely on like official statements and reports and trust everything that an authority figure has put down on paper. But you can't. But, you know, a court reading this or somebody else looking at the file is going to say, oh, wow, yeah, somebody actually saw this car. But it's actually not true.
Colin, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is indicative of the type of deceptive statement you would see in a search warrant affidavit. And it's not surprising, unfortunately. A lot of times you have the officer overstating their case to try to establish probable cause. You know, and Robbie is right. There's not a physical description of the car that's given. And what he's doing in this affidavit is trying to say, well, these witnesses heard the sounds that this engine made, and I can compare it to the sounds of the car that I want to search. And so it matches in that sense, but that's not really legitimate at all. And so he's clearly overstating the case. And that's, you know, we wish we could have the faith and confidence that people are acting in good faith. But this affidavit clearly does not appear to be an act of good faith.
Now, we do have a couple of questions from listeners. Rabia, we got a question from listener on Twitter at PGHGRL at heart. It's one thing for local law enforcement to fall into the, quote, find evidence to fit your suspect trap. It's another thing entirely for the TBI to have done it. Given the victim's profession, something stinks to high heaven here. That's one of the listener questions. Is that why you're doing this series, Rabia? Because you also think that something stinks to high heaven here.
I mean, a lot stinks to high heaven in this case, and we're going to unpack all of it going forward. But, you know, it's interesting that this listener points out, given the victim's profession, and I didn't actually know the victim's profession going into this. I did not know this for a while because the document that showed us what Victor actually did, like, we didn't get possession of that until just a few months ago. And we've been working on this case since last year. So we actually didn't know. I had no idea what Victor did. And many of the people we spoke to had no idea what Victor did before he became kind of that slumlord property guy. So that wasn't why. It was many other things that just didn't add up in this case. And we're going to go through that slowly over the season. But, so
I can't believe that that is like a sub-narrative in this case. To me, yeah. That should be the main narrative in this case, right?
I mean, when I was first told about the case, you know, the locals there were like, you know, it was the Russians and maybe it was a Russian mafia. And, you know, we haven't even explored a mafia angle, but the idea that he was a nuclear scientist, maybe it was a government thing, maybe it has something to do with Russian intelligence. I mean, that just didn't even occur to us until we saw this documentation a few months ago. So there was like this kind of idea floated that maybe, was it a Russian mafia hit? Because apparently Victor would make these trips to New York that nobody knew why he would make these trips to New York, although I think I figured it out, but nobody would really knew why. And so, you know, the locals were suspicious, but they kind of stayed at a distance. They didn't ask much about him.
Okay, so we have another question from another listener who wants to know, why would there be a pool of gas under Victor's body? Would the pool of gas have seeped there? Was there already gas on the floor and he fell in it? Are there any theories about that?
I don't know. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember it's a dynamic crime scene and things are moving. So if that's true, if there was a pool of gas under his body, it could have been either one of those things. It could have seeped underneath him, or his body could have moved after the pour was made, which I would love to see that autopsy. When you combine the pool of gas under his body, the fact that he's clenching the bedpost after he's dead, those two things combined are big indicators that he was still alive when the fire was started. But then the autopsy,
that's what I was
not
thinking as well.
Yeah, so yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's possible that it just, you know, I mean, gasoline's liquid. So if he's laying on the ground, they pour it on the ground, that it just kind of seeped is the word they used underneath of his body. But it still doesn't explain the gripping of the bedpost. That could be, maybe there was a picture of it. If not, maybe there is one somewhere. You know, it could just be that his hand was near the bedpost. And like I said, when the fire will cause the tendons to contract and dry out, and your fist does go into, you know, any dead body that I've come across in a fire, they're kind of curled up and their hands are tightened up like into a fist. So it's possible his hand was just right there, but those two things together seem really hard to explain that he was already dead when the fire started.
Colin, do you have any questions at this point in the case, and this point in the series, that you're looking forward to the show unpacking as the episodes in the series continue?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely avenues in this case that are interesting and that are being explored currently. But yeah, I mean, I think that as Rabia was sort of previewing, it's this question of, you know, obviously at the end of the episode, we previewed, you know, the series title is The State versus Greg Lance, and the state has made this case out against him. But there are so many layers and rabbit holes and alternate theories about what might have happened here that I'm interested in us exploring for the rest of the season.
Well, I can't wait to hear it either. You know, as you know, I produce the episodes, and this was one, the kickoff of this series, that as I was making it and, you know, putting the audio together and kind of listening to the circumstances of the crime unfold, and then at the very end, hear that there was a singular suspect who was the sole focus of the investigation. Just given what I learned in the first episode, I'm certainly fascinated to hear how that came to be and what you uncovered. So, Rabia, thank you so much for reporting on this story for this series. It's fascinating.
Thanks. I'm excited that you are going to be hosting our addendum this whole series. Thanks for doing that, Rebecca.
Oh, I'm really excited too. It's basically a dream come true. and Bob Ruff, I can't thank you enough for bringing your particular expertise to this episode. I hope we get to talk to you again. You certainly know a heck of a lot about this stuff, and it's wonderful hearing your voice on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me, and I'm hooked on, just from episode one, I'm hooked on this case, so I'm here if you need me.
Thank you, Bob.
And Colin Miller, a.k.a. Legal Siri, always a pleasure talking to you and getting your expertise. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, sounds great.
And thanks so much to Rabia Chaudhry and the Undisclosed team for asking me to host the addendum this season. Like I said, it really is kind of a dream come true. Thanks to my team at Crime Writers On and Partners in Crime Media, especially my co-podcaster and husband, Kevin Flynn, who is picking up a whole lot of extra work so that I can host this series. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.
A big thank you to our special guest this week, Bob Ruff. Make sure to check out his podcast, The Truth and Justice Podcast. It's one of my favorites. Thank you to our executive producer, Mital Delhan, to our audio editor, Hannah McCarthy, to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme song. A big thank you to future lawyer and my legal intern, Asra Qureshi. As always, thank you to our sponsors for helping make these productions possible. And of course, thanks to our listeners for coming back week after week to follow these cases. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle is @UndisclosedPod, and we're also on Facebook and Instagram. And make sure every week when you've got questions for the addendum, you tweet them at us, or you can message us on Facebook. Use the hashtag UDAddendum.
I always feel awkward starting this because John Cryer starts it in that super adorable, awkward way where he's like, hello.
You bring your own super competent vibe. to this.
That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. I'm going to be like, hello.
Who is that Rebecca?
Yeah, it's Rebecca.
It's
hey,
Rebecca.
Oh, hey. I didn't realize. I thought Ally Sweeney was doing your guys' addendums now.
She did one series, but I wanted Rebecca to do my series, so.
Okay. Yes, I am. Nice. Yes. How you doing, Bob? I'm sorry you thought I was a different person.
Well, I knew your voice. I just didn't realize you were hosting the addendum.
Bob thought I was a much cooler and thinner and more famous person than I am.
I think he just thought you're on the panel, but you get to be the host, so even
better. Okay. Well, that's a great way to start. Okay. All right, let's go.
This is all the outtakes. Just plug them in at the end. Perfect.
It's perfect. Right. It's perfect.
Yeah.